his funeral in ripped jeans and a T-shirt, people would expect a dress. And she had only one. She pulled it out of the bottom drawer where she had shoved it after her mother's funeral 3 years ago, held on a blazing June day. It was respectable, but far too summery for December, made of cheap, flimsy cotton with short sleeves. She could wear it with tights, though her only pair of tights were laddered at the top of the thigh. Hal unrolled them, examining the damage. She had carefully stopped the run with a blob of nail varnish, and now she would just have to hope that the fix held. Next, a couple of T-shirts, a hoodie, and her least threadbare jeans, a spare bra, a handful of knickers, and finally a precious laptop and a couple of paperbacks. The last thing was the most difficult. ID. They would expect ID. And the letter had asked her to bring it. The problem was, Hal had no idea what information they already had. Her full birth certificate was out of the question, but she could take her passport, or her short-form birth certificate, neither of which made any mention of parents. Those simply confirmed something they already knew, Hal's name. The problem was, they also gave her date of birth. If they were expecting someone aged 35, it would all be over as soon as they saw her. They wouldn't even need to get to the passport. But Hal thought she could pass for anything from 15 to 25, maybe even 30 at a pinch. Unless Hester Westaway had married and had children very young, there was a good chance that the woman they were looking for was within that range. But if the solicitor's document showed a baby born in December 1991, and Hal produced a passport showing she was born in May 1995... Hal pulled out the letter again, scanning for acceptable forms. The second column proving her address was no problem. A utility bill, said the letter. Well, she had plenty of those. And they couldn't possibly tell the solicitors anything they didn't already know, apart from the state of her overdraft. But the first column was more of a problem. Passport, driving license, or birth certificate. She didn't have a driving license, and a passport would be too hard to alter without access to serious cash, which left the birth certificate. Hal rummaged in the box under the bed again, looking for the envelope she had cast aside earlier. When she found it, she flipped past her mother's certificate to her own, beneath. There was the full one, and yes, there beneath it was the short form. Name: Harriet Margarita Westaway, it read. Born 15th of May, 1995. Sex: female. District: Brighton, East Sussex. If they didn't have a date of birth already, it would be easy. A simple question of handing over her real papers. If they did... Hal peered at it, holding it up to the light, looking at the paper. It was not a very sophisticated document. The paper was watermarked, but that wasn't obvious from the surface, and the ink looked nothing special. With a bit of time and a scanner, she could probably use the real document to forge something fairly convincing. The crease lines were old and soft, and Hal folded it up carefully and put it in an inside pocket of the case, along with the utility bill. She was zipping up the case when she stopped and reached into her bedside drawer, where a small tin box rested, battered and losing its paint. It had once held Golden Virginia, though it had long since lost the scent of tobacco. Opening it up, Hal let her fingers rest on the cards inside, feeling their frayed edges, the soft pliability of the aging cardboard, watching the familiar images flicker past as she riffled through them, their faces watching her, judging her. On an impulse, she tipped the pack into her palm and, without shuffling, she made a single cut, her eyes closed, only one question in her mind. She opened her eyes. The card in her palm was a young man standing in a storm-swept landscape, at his back a sky full of scudding clouds, at his feet a tumultuous sea. In his hands was a sword upraised, as if about to strike. The Page of Swords. Action. Intellect. Decision. In that instant, Hal knew, if she were reading for a client, what she would have said. The swords are the suit of the mind, of thought and analysis, and the page is a card full of energy and decision. There are stormy waters all around, but he is striding out with his sword upraised. Whatever the challenge he faces, the page is ready to meet it, and he is someone to be reckoned with. There is no such thing as a clear green light in tarot, she would have said, but this card, this might be the closest thing to it. But below and beneath the practiced spiel, she could hear her mother's voice, words she had told Hal again and again. Never believe it, Hal. Never believe your own patter. The actor who loses his grip on reality, the writer who believes their own lies, they're lost. This is a fantasy. Never lose sight of that, however much you want to believe. And there was the slippery truth of it. The confirmation bias known so well to scientists and skeptics. She wanted to believe the page's message. She wanted to believe in his green light, even as she clapped the two halves of the deck together, slid them back into the tin, and closed the lid. As she brushed her teeth in the tiny bathroom, gazing at her own reflection, soft focus and unfamiliar without her glasses, Hal told herself, I don't have to decide. I can sleep on it. Nothing is final. But she took her toothbrush with her when she went back into the bedroom. She stood uncertainly by her bed for a moment, shivering in the cold breeze from the draughty window, and then almost defiantly she shoved the toothbrush inside the open case and, with a rasping scratch, zipped it up and climbed into bed. It was a long time before she put her book down and turned out the light, and longer still before she slept. And when she slept, she dreamed of a young man standing over her, his sword upraised. Chapter 8. Hal's mother had taught her tarot, and she'd been familiar with the images on the cards almost before she could walk. The smiling high priestess, the stern hierophant, the scary tower with the lost souls falling away. And she had accompanied her mother to the booth on West Pier often enough as a little girl, when school was off and her mother couldn't find anyone to babysit. She'd sat quietly behind the curtain in the corner reading a book, listening to her mother's skillful back and forth, and she grew to understand the tactics almost without realizing. The leading questions, the graceful forks. A brother. A slight frown from the client. No, wait. Someone like a brother. A friend. A male relative. She learned how far to generalize and when to backtrack when you had hit a rut. She watched how her mother stopped trying to apply a statement when the client was stubbornly shaking his or her head, and how she changed tack with an unruffled, Ah, well, I will leave that image with you to decipher. Perhaps its meaning will come to you later, or it may be a warning for the future. So much she had picked up without even trying. But to conduct a reading herself, that was another matter. In the end, though, she had no choice. A couple of days before Hal's 18th birthday, her mother was killed in a hit-and-run on a hot, summery day, right outside their flat, by a speeding driver who was never found. Hal was left reeling, grieving, and broke. When the peer manager, Mr. White, came to her a few weeks later, his ultimatum was not unkind. He wanted to give Hal first refusal, he said, but the kiosk could not remain empty in the height of the season. If she wanted her mother's booth, it was hers, no question, but she would have to start soon. It was June, the pier was full every day and every evening, and shuttered kiosks were bad for everyone. And so, Hal had picked up her mother's cards, turned on the neon sign outside the booth, and become Madame Margarita in her turn. The regular clients were easy. She had watched her mother read time and again for these people, had listened to them spill the details of wayward husbands, tetchy bosses, unhappy children. And the drunken walk-ins were not too bad. She could bluff her way through those. And besides, they tended to be tourists who would never be back. No, it was the bookings that worried her. The people who paid for a full hour's consultation, who rang up beforehand to make sure she would be in. For those, Hal did something her mother had never resorted to. She cheated. It was scary how much you could find out online. Hal had never used Facebook before her mother's death, but in those early, uncertain days she created a fake profile, with an unthreatening picture of a blonde girl taken from Google Images, and christened her Lil Smith. Lil was a conscious choice, a name that could be short for Lily, Lila, Lillian, Elizabeth, or 100 other names. Smith was obvious, as was the unassuming prettiness of the girl. It was amazing how readily people accepted a friend request from someone they had never met. But much of the time, she didn't even need to do that, for their privacy settings were wide open, and she could find out details of their family, their employers, their education and hometown, all without ever leaving her room. Now, as the train sped west, she opened up her laptop and turned her attention to the Westaways, a nervous fluttering in the pit of her stomach. The first Google hit was a death notice in the Penzance Courier for Hester Mary Westaway, born 19th of September 1930, died 22nd of November 2016 at Clowes Court, St. Piran. The brief obituary stated that she was the widow of Erasmus Harding Westaway, by whom she had had three sons and a daughter. She is survived by her sons Harding, Abel and Ezra Westaway, and her grandchildren, read the notice. Was she supposed to be the daughter of one of these men? Neither Abel nor Harding were big Facebook users, but nor were they hard to find. Only one hit came up for each name, and Harding had helpfully listed his hometown as St. Piran, and tagged Abel as his brother. As Hal scrolled down through his profile, looking at photographs of weddings and christenings, family parties and first days at school, she felt a lump in her throat. There was a wife, Mitzi Westaway, née Parker, and three children, Richard, Catherine and Freddie, ranging from early to mid-teens. Abel was younger by a good few years, a kind-looking man with a neat brown beard and hair the colour of dark honey. His relationship status wasn't visible, but scrolling through his profile pictures, Hal picked out a handsome, blue-eyed man called Edward in many of the photos. There was a tagged photograph of the two of them together in Paris on Valentine's Day 2015, and another of them hand in hand at some kind of formal event. "Black and white ball for the orphans of the Philippines," read the caption. Both men were wearing black tie, and Abel was smiling up at his companion with a kind of anxious pride. Both profiles exuded an air of comfortable wealth that made Hal's heart hurt with a kind of longing envy. There was nothing ostentatious, no yachts or Caribbean cruises, but there was casual mention of holidays in Venice, skiing in Chamonix, private schools and tax planning. The evolving slideshow of profile pictures showed children on ponies, four-wheel drive cars and polo equipment, and their Facebook memories were of restaurant meals and family get-togethers. Of Ezra, there was no sign. Judging by Facebook, both Abel and Harding were old enough to have a child in her 20s, but it was the daughter that kept drawing Hal's attention. She is survived by her sons. What had happened to the daughter? Without a name, there was no way of finding out, and there was no mention of a sister on either Harding or Abel's Facebook profiles. After a moment's thought, Hal, or rather Lil Smith, put in a friend request to Harding's eldest son, Richard Westaway. She deliberately did not ask Abel. He had only 93 friends and didn't look the type to accept unsolicited friend requests from mystery girls. Harding was an even worse choice. He had only 19 friends and didn't seem to have checked his account for almost 4 months. Richard, on the other hand, had 576 friends and had already posted an update checking in at a service station outside Exeter. Hal was just opening up another tab when a notification flashed up. Richard had accepted her request. She clicked through to his profile and liked the first photograph that came up, Richard's muddy face brandishing some kind of cup.
Thrashed St. Barnabas at Rugger again. Pretty sure their fly half was a girl with facial hair,
read the caption. Hal rolled her eyes and returned to Google search. There was nothing for Trepassen House on the land registry, and Company's House showed no businesses registered there. It wasn't listed under care homes or inspected as a food premises. There seemed to be no indication that it was anything other than a private home. Google Maps brought it up, though, and Hal switched the view first to satellite and then to Street View. Street View was unhelpful, showing nothing but a country lane flanked by a long brick wall with yews and rhododendrons shrouding anything behind it. Hal clicked along the road for a few miles in either direction until finally she came to a wrought-iron gate across a driveway, but the photo was taken from the wrong angle to show any kind of view of the house, and she switched back to satellite. The blurry image was too small to show anything apart from a gabled roof and a gated expanse of green punctuated by trees, but if nothing else, Hal could see that the place was big. Very big. This looked like a stately home almost. These people had money. Serious money.
"Tickets, please,"
said a voice over her shoulder, breaking into her thoughts, and Hal looked up to see a uniformed guard standing in the aisle next to her. She rummaged in her wallet for a moment and held it out.
"Home for the weekend, are we?"
he said as he punched a hole in it, and Hal was just about to shake her head when something stopped her. She had to step into this part sometime, after all.
"No, I'm going back for a funeral."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
The guard handed her back her ticket.
"Anyone close?"
Hal swallowed. She felt the cliff yawning beneath her feet. "It's just a roll," she told herself. "No different from what you do every day." The words seemed to stick in her throat, but she forced herself on. "My grandmother." For a moment, the statement felt like what it was, a lie. But then she rearranged her face into an expression, not of grief, for that would be too much for this woman she could not possibly be close to, but a kind of solemn regret. And she felt a shiver of something run through her. The same shiver she felt when she switched on the light outside her booth and stepped into her role.
"Very sorry for your loss,"
the guard said, and he nodded gravely and passed on up the corridor and into the next carriage. Hal was putting the ticket back into her near-empty wallet when the train dipped into a tunnel, causing the lights to flicker out, so that for a second
The only illumination was the glow of Hal's laptop and the sparks of the wheels on the track, like lightning flashes against the blackened brick of the tunnel. The screen of her laptop glowed emerald bright, the huge expanse of grass, the narrow snaking road. And suddenly, Hal felt a kind of anger wash over her. How could one family, one person, have so much? The grounds of Trepassen House could fit not just Hal's house, but her entire road and most of the next one. Just the cost of mowing those lawns was probably more than she made in a month. But it wasn't just that, it was everything. The ponies, the holidays, the casual acceptance of it all. How could it be right that some people had so much, while others had so little? The lights came back on with a strobing flicker, and another Facebook notification popped up. Another update from Richard. Hal clicked on it, and a picture filled the screen. Richard and his family against a backdrop of panelled wood, all of them beaming proudly. Harding had his arm clasped so hard around his son that the boy was staggering slightly. "Richard has shared a Facebook memory," said the caption, and peering closer, Hal read,
"Prize-giving day at St. A's. Ma doing the old maternal pride thing so hard, I thought she might rupture something. Just gotta make sure Dad makes good on our deal. 500 squids for not flunking maths, and then hello, Ibiza."
As the train swooped out of the tunnel into daylight, Hal felt again that fluttering sickness in the pit of her stomach. But she knew in that instant that she would not turn back. For the flutter wasn't only nerves, it wasn't even just envy. It was also a kind of excitement. Chapter 9. It was almost 3 when the train drew up at Penzance. Hal paused for a moment beneath the big clock hanging above the platform, the sounds of the station echoing around her, trying to decide what to do. "Taxis," read a sign above her head, and she shouldered her bag and followed the direction arrow to a rank at the front of the station. But a few feet away from the "Queue Here" sign, she paused and checked in her wallet. After a sandwich on the train, egg and cress, the cheapest on offer at £1.37, she had £37.54 left. But would that be enough to get her as far as St. Piran? And if it was, how would she get back?
"You waiting, sonny?"
said a voice from behind her, making her jump. Hal turned, but there was no one in sight. It was only when a face leaned out of the taxi cab window that she realised it was a taxi driver who had spoken.
"Oh, sorry."
She shoved her wallet back in her bag and walked across to the taxi.
"Yes, I am."
"Sorry, my love."
The man's face was red as she approached.
"I didn't realise. It was the short hair, see?"
"It's fine,"
Hal said, honestly. It happened too often for it to bother her anymore.
"Listen, can you tell me how much to get to St. Piran's Church? I've not got very much cash on me."
Or off me, she thought, but didn't say. The taxi driver looked away and began tapping something into a screen on the dashboard. A sat-nav or a phone, Hal thought, though she wasn't sure.
"About 25 quid, my darling,"
he said at last. Hal drew a breath. This was it, then. If she got in this cab, she was stranded. No way back without relying on the goodwill of whoever she found at the other end. Was she really going to do this? The train now departing from Platform 3 is the delayed 1449 to London Paddington, said the tinny voice of the station announcer, breaking into her thoughts like the universe reminding her once again she didn't have to follow this through, that she could simply turn round and catch the train straight back home, where Mr. Smith would be waiting for her in 6 days' time. If anyone can pull this off, it's you.
Do you hear me?
The taxi driver asked. His Cornish burr made the words sound less abrupt than they would have coming from a Brighton cabbie.
£25, I said. Is that all right?
Hal took another deep breath and looked back at the train station. The pictures from Facebook and Google rose up in front of her eyes. The sprawling expanse of land, the holidays, the cars, the clothes, like stills from a Jack Wills brochure. She thought of the heel grinding into her mother's photograph, of the smashed ornaments in her kiosk, and the fear she had felt when that lamp clicked on. She thought of what she would give for just a couple of £1,000 of that money. Not even enough to buy one of those cars, a tenth of it, maybe. They have everything already. They don't need more money. She felt again that sensation of something sharp and hard crystallizing inside her. A kind of hot pain cooling into brittle resolve. If she failed, she would be stranded. So she would just have to ensure that she didn't fail. All right. The driver reached back and the rear door of the taxi swung open, and with a feeling like she was about to step off a cliff, Al pushed her mother's suitcase inside and climbed in after.
Looks like a funeral,
said the voice from the front seat of the car, and Al jumped and looked up.
Sorry, what did you say?
I says, it looks like a funeral, the driver repeated. At the church. Is that what you're here for? Relative, is it?
Hal peered out of the window, through the lashing rain that had started as they left Penzance. It was hard to see much through the gale, but she could make out a small stone church perched on a headland with grey clouds swirling behind and a little gaggle of black-coated mourners at the entrance to the graveyard.
Yes,
she said, almost under her breath. And then more loudly, as the driver cupped his hand to his ear,
yes, that's what I'm here for. It's...
She hesitated, but it was easier the second time around.
It's my grandmother.
Well, I'm very sorry for your loss, my darling,
the driver said, and he took off his flat cap and placed it on the seat beside him.
How much do I owe you? Hal asked.
20 be fine, my love.
Hal nodded, and she counted out one £10 note and two fives onto the little tray between them, and then paused. Could she afford a tip? She looked at the coins left in her purse, counting them under her breath, wondering how she was going to get from the church to the house. But from here she could see the digital display in the cab, and it read £22.50. Damn. He had undercharged her. Feeling guilty, she put another pound on the tray.
Thank you kindly,
the driver said, scooping up the change.
Take care in that rain now, my darling. Catch your death on a day like today.
The words made Hal shiver for some reason, but she only nodded, opened the door, and slid out into the driving rain. As the car drew away, its tyres splashing in the wet road, Hal stood for a second, trying to get her bearings. The rain spattered the lenses of her glasses, and at last she took them off to peer through the downpour at the light gate in front of her, and the little grey church hunched against the cliff top. A low stone wall encircled the graveyard, and beyond it Hal could see a dark rift in the ground. It was too blurry to be certain, but from the shape, she felt fairly sure it must be the open grave, awaiting the coffin of the woman she was about to defraud. For a moment, Hal had an almost overwhelming urge to turn and run, no matter that it was 30 miles to the nearest train station, no matter that she had no money, and her cheap black coat and shoes were no match for the driving rain. But as she stood, hesitating in the downpour, a hand tapped her shoulder, and she swung violently round to find a little man with a neat grey beard, peering at her from behind rain-misted glasses.
"Hello,"
he said, his voice a strange mix of diffidence and assertion.
"Might I be of assistance? My name is Mr. Tresick. Are you here for the funeral?"
Hal hastily put her own glasses back on, but they did nothing to make the face in front of her more familiar. The name Tresick rang a bell, though, and Hal searched frantically through her mental file of names, trying to match the figure in front of her with a family member, and then suddenly, with a rush of mingled relief and trepidation, she found it.
"Mr. Tresick, you wrote to me," she said.
She put out a hand.
"I'm Hal. I mean, Harriet Westaway."
At least, put like this, it was not a lie. Not exactly, anyway. There was a pause. Hal felt her stomach clench with nerves. This was the moment of truth. Or one of them. If the real Harriet Westaway was 35, or blonde, or 6 foot tall, it was all over before it had begun. She could kiss goodbye to even entering the church, let alone a legacy. It would be back to Brighton on the same train, with her wallet dented and her pride considerably bruised. Mr. Tresick didn't say anything at first. He only shook his head, and Hal felt her stomach drop away.
Oh, God, it was over. It was all over.
But then, before she could think what to say, he took her hand, pressing it between two warm leather gloves.
"Well, well, well."
He was still shaking his head in disbelief, Hal realised.
"Well, I never. How very, very glad I am that you could make it. I wasn't certain you would receive the letter in time. It was not an easy task tracking you down, I must say. Your mother..."
He seemed suddenly to think better of the direction the conversation was taking, and stopped, covering his confusion by removing his glasses and wiping the rain from them.
"Well,"
he said as he resettled them on his nose,
"never mind that now. Let's just say it was touch and go that we found you in time. But I am so glad you were able to attend."
"Your mother..." In the sea of uncertainty, the words felt like something firm for Hal to hang on to. One fact she could begin to build upon. So it was as she'd thought. Mrs. Westaway's dead daughter was her link to all this. Hal had a sudden picture of herself wading through shifting, clutching mud and finding something solid to rest on for a moment.
"Of course,"
she said, and managed to smile in spite of the way her teeth were clenched against the cold.
"I'm glad too." "Oh, but you're shivering," Mr. Tresick said solicitously. "Let me show you inside the church. It's an absolutely filthy day, and I'm afraid St. Piran's has no heating at all, so it's not much better inside. But at least you'll be dry. Have you..."
He paused as they reached the light gate, opening it up and standing aside for Hal to pass through.
"Have I?"
she prompted, as they stood in the shelter for a moment. Mr. Tresick polished his glasses again, futilely, Hal realised, looking at the stretch of graveyard they still had to cover.
"Have you met your uncles?"
he asked diffidently. And Hal felt a sudden flood of warmth around her heart in spite of the chilly day.
Uncles. Uncles. She had uncles.
"You do not," she told herself sternly, trying to dampen down the sensation. "They are not your relatives." But she could not think like that. If she were going to pull this off, she had not only to pretend, she had to believe. But what should she say? How could she answer his question? She stood for a long moment, trying to think, before suddenly realising that she was gaping at Mr. Tresick, and that the little man was looking at her puzzled.
"No," she said at last.
That, at least, was a no-brainer, There was no point in pretending she knew people who were standing right over there and who could give her story the lie the instant they saw Mr. Trezick.
No, I never have. To be honest,
she bit her lip, wondering if this was the right path to take, but surely it was better to tell the truth where she could.
To be honest, she finished in a rush, I didn't know I had any uncles until you wrote. My mother never mentioned them.
Mr. Trezick said nothing, only shook his head again, though whether in resigned understanding or baffled denial, Hal wasn't sure.
Shall we?
He asked, glancing up at the iron-grey sky above.
I don't think the rain is going to lighten at all, so we might as well make a dash for it.
Hal nodded, and together they scurried the short distance from the light gate to the church. In the porch, Mr. Trezick wiped his glasses yet again and tightened the belt of his Macintosh before ushering Hal inside. But as he was about to follow, his head cocked like a spaniel's, and he turned back at the sound of an engine.
Ah, if you will excuse me, Harriet, I believe that is the funeral cortege. May I leave you to seat yourself?
Of course, Hal said, and he disappeared into the rain, leaving her to enter the church alone. The door was just ajar, as some protection from the driving wind and rain, but as she slipped inside, the first thing that struck her was not the cold, but the lack of people. There could not have been more than 4 or 5 people dotted about the pews. She had assumed that the group of mourners she had seen from the taxi were latecomers, joining those already in the church, but now she realized that she must have seen the arrival of almost everyone here. There were 3 very elderly women in the second pew from the front, a man in his 40s who looked like an accountant seated towards the back, and a woman in a district nurse's uniform perched by the entrance as if poised to make a quick getaway should the service drag on. Hal looked around, trying to assess where she should sit. Was there a rule with funerals? She tried to remember her mother's service at Brighton Crematorium, but all she could recall was the little chapel overflowing with peer folk and neighbours, grateful clients, old friends, and people she didn't even recognise, but whose lives her mother's had touched. At the back, they had been standing, crushing against the wall to make room for more mourners, and she'd seen Sam from the fish and chip kiosk giving his seat to an elderly neighbour at Marine View Villas. Someone had kept a place for Hal at the front, but for the rest, she was not sure how they'd decided who sat where or what hierarchy of mourning might apply. Whatever the rules were, though, surely anyone who had never met the deceased ranked pretty low. In the end, she took a seat towards the back, but not so conspicuously as the accountant and the district nurse, 3 or 4 rows in front of them on the right-hand side. Her glasses were still streaked with drying raindrops, and she took them off to clean them, listening, as she did so, to the rustle of feet, the drumming of the rain on the roof, and the occasional cough from the women at the front. She tried not to shiver. Hal had only 2 coats, the battered leather jacket she wore every day, and a dark trench coat Macintosh that had been her mother's and was too big for her. The leather jacket was black at least, but it hadn't seemed right for a funeral, so she had worn the trench coat. It had felt warm enough on the train, but at some point in its long storage, its waterproofing had worn off, and the fabric had soaked right through in the brief run from the taxi. Now, she sat in the cold church and felt the rain leeching through to her skin. Her hands, when she looked down at them in her lap, were bluish, and she had to shove them into the pockets of the flimsy coat to stop her fingers shaking with cold. At the bottom of one of the pockets, she felt something round and rough chafe against her numb skin, and when she pulled it out, she smiled. Gloves. Something warm, at least. It felt like a present from her mother.
She was just pulling them on when there was a blast of sound from an unseen organist, and the doors of the chapel were flung open, letting in a gust of wind that sent the thin paper orders of service scurrying down the aisle.
The priest, or vicar, Hal was not sure which, came in first, and behind him came four men in black suits, holding between them a narrow, dark wood coffin. The rear left-hand bearer, Hal recognised straight away as Mr. Treswick, his Macintosh shed to reveal a black suit and tie beneath. He was struggling a little with his position, for he was shorter than the other three men, and kept having to raise his corner higher than was comfortable to compensate. At the front right was a balding man in his 50s that Hal thought must be Harding Westaway. She looked hard at his round, jowly face and pale, wispy hair, trying to imprint it on her memory. He had the air of a man who had eaten a good meal but would always want more, nibbling at nuts and cheese and fruit, and then complaining of the subsequent indigestion. There was something both self-satisfied and yet self-doubting about him. It was a strange combination. As Hal watched, he brushed at his hair a little self-consciously, as though feeling her appraising eyes. To his left was a bearded man with dark blonde hair fading to grey at the temples, who looked close enough to Abel Westaway for Hal to identify the final bearer as the third son, Ezra. He was by far the youngest man in the group, and where his brothers were fair, Ezra was dark and deeply tanned. He was also the only person in the whole church who was not wearing an expression of careful sorrow. In fact, as he drew level with Hal, he flashed her a curving Cheshire cat smile, and she felt a jolt of shock. It was so very inappropriate for the time and place. In confusion, she turned away, pretending she hadn't seen, and faced the front of the church, feeling her cheeks burn. It wasn't just the smile, though that was bad enough. It was that there had been something flirtatious in his grin, in the twinkling eye, close to a wink. "He doesn't know he's your uncle," she told herself. "He has no idea who you are." "That's because he's not your uncle," replied her conscience snippily. It was like two voices warring in her head. Hal pressed her gloved hands to her forehead, feeling the coldness of the rain still soaked into the wool. And she knew if she didn't get it together, she wouldn't even make it as far as the wake. She would be found out for the impostor she was before they had even left the church. The bearers made their slow way past her, deposited the narrow coffin at the top of the church, and filed dutifully into the pews at the front, followed by the little gaggle of family members trailing behind. And the service began. Chapter 10. An hour later, it was over, or almost. The sparse congregation filed out into the driving rain to stand around the grave as the coffin was lowered into the raw earth, and the priest raised his voice to intone blessings over the shriek of the wind off the sea. It was almost dusk now, and the temperature had dropped even further. Hal was shivering uncontrollably in her thin coat, but nevertheless she was grateful for the wind and the rain. Under cover of the weather, no one could read her expression as anything other than pinched and pained. Her eyes were watering with genuine tears as she blinked away the drops that trickled from her hair into her eyes. No one would have expected her to cry, she knew that. But the next test was the wake, back at Trepassen House, and Hal knew that there she could not escape scrutiny. It was a relief not to have to think about the expression on her face or her defensive body language for just a few minutes. Here,
huddled around the grave with the wind lashing in the mourners' faces, she could hug herself protectively and blame nothing but the weather. At last, though, the priest said his final words, and Harding threw a handful of gritty earth from the covered bucket at the side of the grave. It splashed rather than thudded onto the wooden coffin lid, and he passed the pail to his brother, Abel, who threw a handful in his turn, shaking his head as he did, though Hal could not tell what the gesture meant. Round the circle it went, handful after handful, a few flowers, limp with wet, following the earth into the grave. The last to take the pail was Ezra. He flung the earth almost carelessly, and then turned to Hal, standing in his shadow just behind his shoulder, trying to efface herself from notice. He said nothing, just held out the bucket, and Hal took it. As she did, the feeling struck her that there was something profoundly wrong in what she was about to do, blasphemous, almost, in this symbolic act of burying a woman she had no connection with. But the eyes of the family were upon her, and she had no choice. The earth was clagged with rain now, and she had to pull off her glove and dig into the mud with her nails. It thudded down onto the coffin with a strange finality, and she handed the pail back to the curate.
"Ashes to ashes," said the priest over the noise of the wind and waves. "Dust to dust. In sure and certain hope of the resurrection to eternal life."
Hal wiped her muddy palm surreptitiously on her trench coat and tried to shut out his words, but the memories kept intruding. Of the kind vicar who had presided over her mother's cremation, of his meaningless words of comfort and the promises she could not believe. She felt the mud grit beneath her fingernails, and she remembered with a force that felt like a blow to the chest the feeling of her mother's ashes gritting against her palm as she had scattered them another December day 3 years ago. She had gone to Brighton Beach on a day as windy as this, though dry, and she had walked down to the edge of the sea, her bare feet cold against the stones, and stood among the foamy weeds, watching as the ashes had tugged from her fingers and scattered across the sea. As she stood, looking into the raw, wet mouth of the grave, Hal felt her heart clutch again with the pain of loss, as if an old, half-healed wound had been struck. Was it really worth doing this? Putting herself through this again, the grim rituals of mourning and remembrance, for what could be nothing more than an ugly lamp or a collection of postcards? There are two paths ahead of you. They twist and turn. She found her nails were digging into her palms, and she thought of the Page of Swords, striding out to meet the stormy seas, his sword upraised, his face determined. The truth was, the two paths were gone now. She had chosen one and shut off the possibilities of the other as if it had never existed. There was no way back, no point in second-guessing her decision. She had made the choice she needed in order to survive, and now the only way out was to push forward, deeper into the deception. She could quite literally not afford to fail. At last the final words were spoken, the priest began picking up his things, and the rest of the family began scattering, moving off towards the cars, their collars raised against the driving wind and rain. Hal felt a flutter of fear in her stomach. She had to say something, and quickly. She had to ask one of them for a lift. But the thought of approaching these total strangers out of the blue was suddenly almost more terrifying than anything else. It wasn't just the fear of being found out. It was something more basic, more childlike. Who should she ask? How?
I...
she said, but her throat felt stiff and croaky.
I... is it...
None of them turned. Harding was in the front, surrounded by his three teenage children and flanked by a woman who must be Mitzi. She recognized Richard from Facebook, already fiddling with his phone as he followed his father towards the car park. Abel and Ezra were walking behind, deep in conversation. As she watched, Abel put his arm around his brother, squeezing him tightly as if in consolation, and Ezra shrugged away a little impatiently. The others had already scattered to a clutch of cars parked beneath the dripping yews. She was in danger of being left behind in this deserted graveyard. Panic rose up in her throat.
"Excuse me?"
she croaked again, more loudly. And then, as before, she felt a hand on her shoulder and turned sharply to see Mr. Treswick standing there, his umbrella held out.
"Harriet, may I offer you a lift back to Trepasson?"
"Yes. Oh, yes."
Hal felt the words tumbling out almost incoherently. "Oh, thank you so much. I wasn't sure."
"There will be no room in the funeral cars, I'm afraid. All the seats in the official cortege are taken up. But if you don't mind sharing my own car..."
"Not at all,"
Hal said. Her teeth were chattering with cold, and she swallowed, trying to steady herself, make her gratitude less naked.
"Thank you, Mr. Treswick, I really appreciate it."
"Not at all. Here, you hold the umbrella. Mind it doesn't turn inside out. I'm afraid the sea gusts are rather unpredictable. And I will take your case."
"Oh, no," Hal protested. "Please."
But it was too late. Somehow the little man had deftly removed the case from where she had let it rest on the gravelled path, and the umbrella was in her hand, and he was forging through the rain to the car, parked down by the verge where the taxicab had set her down. Inside the Volvo, Mr. Treswick turned the heating up full, and as the car pulled out into the lane, splashing through the rutted puddles, Hal felt some of the chill begin to leave her fingers. In the graveyard, she had thought that she might never be warm again. It was as if the cold had gone right through to her bones. Now, the hot air blasting from the vents on the dashboard made her fingers sting and ache with the shock of the thaw, though the chilliness deep inside her seemed impenetrable.
"It's about 4 miles to Trepasson," Mr. Treswick said conversationally as they wound slowly down the lane to the main road, the wipers frantically swishing back and forth. At the crossroads, they stopped while he peered through the gloom up and down the road, trying vainly to see if there was a car coming, and eventually, with a feeling of taking both their lives in his hands, he stamped on the accelerator and the car jolted across the junction and picked up speed. "I hope Mrs. Warren will have tea waiting for us. Are you staying the night?"
Hal
felt a jolt of guilt. She had not been able to write, there had been no time, and she had no idea what she would do if the invitation to stay was rescinded.
"I would love to, yes, but I'm afraid I wasn't able to tell Mrs. Warren I was coming. Your letter only arrived 2 days ago. I didn't think a reply would get here in time."
"Oh, I am sorry, I should have put in a telephone number," Mr. Treswick said apologetically. "But no matter. Mrs. Warren will be able to open up a room, I'm sure. I should warn you..."
He glanced doubtfully at Hal's wet coat and soaking clothes beneath.
"There is no central heating at Trepasson, I'm afraid. Mrs. Westway never got round to having it installed. But there are plenty of fires and hot water bottles and so on. You should be..."
He hesitated.
"Well, fairly comfortable."
"Thank you," Hal said meekly, though something in his tone made her doubt the truth of his words.
"I must say," Mr. Trezick changed gear as they crested a hill. I was a little surprised to find out that Maud had had a child.
Maud. So that was the missing daughter's name. M. Westaway.
Like her mother. Was that where the mistake had originated? Hal felt a silent wash of thankfulness that she had not brought her full birth certificate, followed by a flicker of something else, a kind of alarm. What did Mr. Trezick mean, he was surprised Maud had had a child? Was there something she needed to know? Could she ask, or would her ignorance give her away?
What do you mean? She asked at last.
Oh, Mr. Trezick gave a laugh. She was very decided as a young woman, always swore she would never get married, never have children. I remember telling her once, she must have been about 12 at the time, you may feel differently when you're grown up, my dear, and she laughed and said I was an old fool. She was rather forthright, your mother. She told me children were nothing but padlocks on the patriarchal shackles of marriage. That was the phrase she used. I remember it rather well. I recall thinking at the time that it was rather an unusual turn of phrase, particularly for a child of that age. So I was a little taken aback to learn that she had, in fact, had a child, and fairly young too, as I understand it.
She was 18, Hal said faintly. When she had me, 18.
When she was a child, it had seemed a perfectly reasonable age. Grown up, in fact. Now she was 21 herself, she could not imagine what her mother had been through. The struggle it must have been to have a child so young and care for it alone. But the words were barely out of her mouth when she realized her mistake and felt a rush of cold fury prickled down the back of her neck at what she had just let slip. Damn! Damn! What a stupid, amateurish mistake. It was the first rule of cold reading. Be as vague as possible. Try not to offer specific information, unless you can retract or twist the meaning if you've got it badly wrong. Always, I'm getting a man's name. A name with an F in it? Rather than, I'm hearing from your cousin Fred. If you must guess at a specific, make it one that's statistically probable. I'm seeing a blue car. Never a green one. Hal had just committed two grave errors in less than 5 words. She had given a specific, unnecessary piece of information, and it was one that was statistically unlikely to be right. How many women had children at 18? 2%? Less? She had no idea. But even setting that aside, she didn't know enough about the facts of this woman's life to make guesses like that. What if Maud would have been in her 50s now? So that elementary maths would tell Mr. Trezick the relationship was impossible. What if she had still been at home at the age of 18? Hal had been lulled by the false reassurance of Mr. Trezick's, fairly young as I understand it, a piece of information that had seemed to chime so neatly with Hal's own life. But there was fairly young, and
fairly young.
A 25-year-old mother was fairly young these days. She had just slipped up, and badly. Hal looked nervously across to see if Mr. Trezick had begun frowning, adding up figures in his head. But he didn't seem to have noticed her mistake. In fact, he barely seemed to have heard her remark at all. His mind was travelling down other paths.
"The patriarchal shackles of marriage," he said with a chuckle. "That phrase will always remind me of your mother. Though, of course," he threw a brief glance at her, his eyes bright as a robin's, "she never did marry, I understand."
"No," Hal said.
In spite of the chill in her bones, her face felt hot, scorched by the blast from the fan heater. How stupid she had been. From now on, she would not offer information, just corroborate what others had already told her. Though, perhaps... They turned a corner, the tyres shushing in the wet, and Hal pressed her cheek to the cold window and tried to think. Perhaps she hadn't been such a fool to admit her mother's age. It was very possible, probable even, that she would be caught out at some point. Perhaps it was better to volunteer honest information now, so that if she were caught, she could represent the whole thing as a misunderstanding. Luckily picked up, rather than a cold-blooded deception. If she started lying now, there would be no way out later on. Not without prosecution for fraud. Maud Westaway. If only she had known about the name, she could have Googled on the train, found out something about this woman who was supposed to be her mother. What did she look like? How